God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance tonight. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively. Is there anyone in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you. Hey, Stephanie, welcome. Hey, Tom, welcome. Hey, Courtney, you're welcome.
Hey, Grady,
welcome. Welcome. Yes.
Hey, Ethan,
welcome. Oh, that was awesome. Yeah. If you are on Zoom, you can raise your hand and someone will chat with you. Is anyone visiting from out of town or new to the meeting?
Oh.
Yes.
Well,
Jerome?
Right.
Jerome, pardon me. Okay.
Hey, Rob.
Hey,
welcome. Welcome. Good to have you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted. This is from the foreword to the first edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100. Am I yelling? It's loud.
That's
okay,
good.
All right, okay. Yeah. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And besides, we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism by taking AA's simple actions. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. This evening, we are discussing Step 4, Part 2, Fear and Sex. Please welcome our panel. We have Elizabeth and Dave. I will read the first paragraph, which is on page 67. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on that reading. Step 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Page 67. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Dave is going to go first.
Hey, I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Grateful to be here at Simple Actions, my favorite places. Thanks for asking me, Amy. And I am going to read from, I had to write my notes down because I'm not very good off the cuff, especially with these subjects. So please bear with me doing that. But here goes. All right. I'm a member of the New Day Group in Virginia Beach. Sobriety day is July 14th, 2002. During my drinking days, I would never really admit to fear, even to myself. I basically ignored most of my emotions and feelings while at the same time drinking to cover them up or forget them. We're talking here, of course, about self-centered fear. By the time I got to step 4, I knew that I had actually been a big gooey puddle of fear my whole life. And as the reading said, most of my decisions and reactions to life were the result of or based on fear. And those decisions and reactions led to disastrous circumstances. Of course, after working the steps, I could see how hollow many of these fears were and how much time and effort was put into averting fear and not living life. All the character defects I identified in step four were fear-based, and most of those fears were easily dismissed through not drinking and working the steps and coming to believe in a power greater than myself. Love and faith are the antidotes to fear for me. Thanks.
Thank you.
My name's Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Elizabeth.
My sobriety date is May 29th, 2017. I'm currently homeless. I don't have a home group. I do have a service commitment in the district, though, so I get around, as they say. Fear, right? I had a lot of fear coming into the rooms. Like, first of all, I didn't want to come into the rooms. I was kind of forced in by other people or dragged in by my family or ordered by the courts. It was never an idea that I put into my own head. It was always something that someone imposed on me. And I remember early on thinking like, I don't want to do that fourth step. Like, I have so much fear against it. I'm going to drink again. My sponsor at the time was like, it's Tuesday. You're going to drink. Like, it doesn't have anything to do with the fourth step. Just stay where your feet are. Like, so, I love the sentence where it says, it's an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. I would tell you, I didn't deserve any of the shit that happened to me in my life. Like, I had no part of it. Although when I sat down and I started with a sponsor going through the big book, like, I was like, okay, I can talk about other people. I can talk about my resentments, right? I'm like writing everything down, like, so-and-so, I hate him because of this. So-and-so, I hate him because of this, right? And then when I had to get to that fourth column and look at my part of it, I was like, whoa, I didn't sign up for that. But I did, right? I was willing to go to any lens for victory over alcohol. But for me, fear is one of those things where I was full of fear my entire life. That's why I drank. I was afraid of you getting to know me. I was afraid you wouldn't like me. I was afraid you would like me. I was afraid that you would want something from me. I was afraid that, you know, I wouldn't be able to show up to family dinner without a drink. And in the end, I couldn't show up for anything without a drink. Like, I drank because I could not stand the way that I felt inside. So fear was riddled through my entire life. And I would tell you that you were my problem, not Elizabeth. So it was a big shift for me to come into the rooms and to realize that I was my problem, right? My self-centeredness, my will to bully you, to mastermind. Like, I used to be like really happy when like someone would tell me no, because then I was like, ooh, I get to flip the script, right? I'm going to manipulate you into doing what I want you to do. That was a real high for me. And honestly, it can still be today if I'm not like right-sized. So I definitely got the ball rolling almost in every single instance on my inventory. And today I can still do it if I'm not careful. So that's all I have on the first one.
All right, we're going to continue the reading on page 68. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. For we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear.
I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
As I said, many of my self-centered fears dissipated as I worked through the steps and came to believe. Most of my fears had never come to realization anyway. They were just the way I talked myself into certain self-centered behaviors, and mostly into not doing things that most people do without a thought. Yeah. Like showing up to work on time or even showing up every day. Yeah, I just couldn't seem to do that. I was scared, of course, because of the things I'd been doing. Getting scared of being found out, scared of, you know, they were going to know what was really going on with me. Of course, they did eventually, but I still believe that they didn't. So, yeah, I'd never showed up where I told my family I would be. Well, I occasionally would make it, but, you know, I'd come up with these big lies like, oh, there was, you know, it's Christmas, I'm going to be there. Then I get paid, you know, like 2 days before Christmas. And then I'm calling them, telling them, oh, I didn't have a car or license. I'm taking the bus and there was a wreck in the tunnel and they put us on vans and took us back to Norfolk. All these big lies, you know, that I think I got to believe that, right? Well, you know, the bigger the lie, the less likely it is they're going to believe it, you know. But my thinking was not very good at those times. You know, today, through doing all of that, though, I can now show up and I can now be there for people. I go where I say I'm going to go. I'll be there when I say I'm going to be there. I try to give back to AA what was so freely given to me. There's no fear in any of that, you know. I'm just, at this point, so used to doing it. It's how I live, and I love it, you know, doing that. Also, by working through the steps and taking that honest look at myself, I found out that God had been there the whole time. You know, I had a real problem with God when I got here because, you know, I thought I'd broken all the rules and, you know, I hadn't gotten my Christmas list of stuff I wanted from God. And you know, but then with a little sobriety and a good sponsor and working through the steps, I realized, you know, I had all these opportunities to change, all these different directions I could have gone, but the drinking direction always won out. Yeah. Like you, I've had many opportunities and was invited many times to AA by many different people. I went to one meeting at 19 after my first DUI, and I said, they're talking about not drinking. I'm not going back. Yeah, and I didn't. I mean, I had a lot more DUIs and other things, and I never came back. But God never gave up on me. He kept giving me those opportunities. He put people in my life that kept me alive, basically, and until the time came where I couldn't take it anymore and I was able to surrender. And now, you know, I see people in here walking through that fear. You know, courage in the absence of fear is walking through it, you know, but we learn that it's going to be okay, you know, and it's going to be better if we just go ahead and do it. You know, I was such a procrastinator and just all that. And, you know, now I just, you know, I pray, I ask for help, and I walk through these things. So lastly, you know, I still have like some of my old friends I talk with a lot, spend a lot of time with, and some of them have doubts about God and stuff. And they asked me how I came to believe. And I just said, you know, I came to believe that God lives inside of each and every one of us. And my heart and my stomach primarily, and my heart tells me when I'm doing the right thing and my stomach tells me when I'm doing the wrong thing. And he seemed to, yeah, these people seem to understand that. And you know, it works for me anyway. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. My name's Elizabeth. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Elizabeth.
When I came into the program, I came in through the psych center. And I had a doctor who pushed the big book across the table to me and said, you need a spiritual awakening. And I was like, I thought you were the doctor and you're going to give me an antidepressant. And he's like, no, I'm one of you. And I'm like, one of me? Like, there's only one of me, mister. And so he started to tell me about the big book. And I was like, yeah, I've heard of it. And he was like, the spiritual awakening. So I go home and I buy 23 books on spirituality so that I can do a bunch of research to find out what the answer is. These two people on the side of me, it's funny that I'm here tonight. They had a big influence on me when I was in the psych center. Dave was bringing meetings in every Wednesday. Yep. And you know, week after week, I'd be like, I don't know what this guy's talking about, but okay. And I would call Amy and she would just keep saying, like, just rely on your higher power. But I had a really hard time with that because I grew up in the church, in the church with the Santa Claus God, that when you do good, you get good. When you do bad, you get bad. A lot of really bad things happened to me. So I must be really bad. And I just rejected the whole idea because I have that Christmas list. Like, why am I not a size six with a millionaire husband living on the beach and, you know, all my student debt released? You know, I thought all those things were due to me. But I learned over time that, like, when I started to go through the steps, I realized, like, my higher power had been there all along. Like, the time that I came this close from a bicyclist, when, you know, drinking and driving, the time that I dropped my baby nephew on his head when he was 6 weeks old because I was drinking and babysitting, like, the time, you know, time after time after time, the time that I got arrested for a DUI, and I'm like, no, I don't think I need to go to jail. And the judge was like, yeah, 5 days. And I was like, no, this isn't going to work for me. And I called someone in the rooms and they were like, you can walk through this, right? You can walk through anything sober. So for me, I've started to learn to trust over time. It didn't come easily for me. And my first thought is not to stop and pray. You know, my first thought is of me, like, what am I going to do in this situation? My big brain has to work it out really quickly. Like today, funny enough, I had to recertify my student loans, waiting till the last minute, you know, and I'm full of fear. And it took 10 minutes. Like, why did I like make such a big deal about it? But I just prayed and got through it. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. So I've started to definitely lean into the idea of what a higher power is. It doesn't have to be yours. It doesn't have to be the church's. For me, it's just like, I'm usually first thought wrong. So I do the opposite, or I call someone in the rooms and say, like, I was thinking about this today. Does this make sense to you? And they're like, yeah, no. So I've begun to pray every day, multiple times a day, and to ask where I can be of service, because when I'm being of service, I'm not thinking about myself. And for that, that's been a real lifesaver for me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, to, you know, just shut up and to listen to someone else. That's all I have for that one.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
All right, we're going to continue on page 68. Now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there. But above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes, perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. Then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or that it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us all on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them?
Hi, I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Dave.
Being self-centered to the extreme, I never really gave much thought to other people's sex life and whether they use too much salt or pepper. Yeah. I can tell you now that, yeah, self-centeredness, selfishness, and alcoholism had a great impact on my sex life. And it was very negative. Yeah. I really should say my relationship life, because I didn't have a lot of sex outside of relationships. But yeah, I was truly, as the book says, I was truly incapable of having a true partnership with another human being. My early relationships, what I thought were typical teen romances with the, you know, either not enough sex or great sex, but I wasn't good enough evidently, cause it didn't last. And yeah. But I never gave much thought to the emotional support of my partner or being, you know, talking to them about what was going on with them. You know, there was a certain amount of time to drink and have sex, basically, you know, go to the party, you know, let's cram it all in and get it done, you know. that romances didn't last long. I was usually told it was because I never talked about anything real. Imagine that. Yeah. I mean, I had one girl that she called me out. Yeah, she had me come out to her house, and we were sitting in the room with her father when she told me she was breaking up with me. And yeah, I didn't think I was all that scary, but I can tell you that I stopped and got a six pack on the way home and drove about 80 miles an hour listening to Freebird. And I did a 360 in the road. So, you know, God was there too. My longest relationship was started in college. It was about 7 years. I was so emotionally bound up, you know, I could just not be part of it. She would ask me what I was thinking or what I was feeling, and it was like white noise would go off in my head. One, because mainly just because I didn't know. Yeah, I didn't know about this inventory process. I didn't know how to share feelings. I didn't grow up in a house where you shared feelings, and for other reasons, you know, it always seemed to go south if I did. But yeah, it was terrible. And of course, that fear of exposing myself, of being intimate in that way, led to anger. You know, under anger is fear, and there was a fair amount of yelling. There was nothing physical, but there's a fair amount of yelling. Now, you know, what kept us together is she was an alcoholic too. Yeah, we did a lot of drinking together and a lot of partying. But finally, she realized that, you know, I wasn't going to change, obviously, and she left, and I was relieved. Yeah, actually, I loved her in whatever way I could at that time, but I knew I couldn't be what she needed or what she wanted, and also couldn't answer those questions. You know, I didn't even want to get into that again. So, she did send me some AA books, if you heard my story, and some amends letters, and I threw them in the junk drawer. So she got sober soon after that and still sober today. Took me a while longer. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah. Absurd extremes. Like, for me, relationships is definitely a really hot button topic. I will weaponize sex. I will weaponize, you know, relationships so that I can get what I need from you without having to give you anything of me. You know, I had some trauma happen to me when I was 5, and that was sort of the basis of my understanding that tell a lot of lies, right? Keep your secrets to yourself. Don't trust anyone. Don't become vulnerable. Don't open up. Don't. And so early on, I realized that men was another drug for me. You know, I used men just like I used alcohol and anything else. When I did my first inventory, and we got to the sex inventory, I lied. I wasn't going to tell this person like everything that I had done and how I had hurt these people. And I definitely didn't want to make any amends to anybody. Absurd extremes, it definitely, got worse and worse. My longest relationship was with a newcomer. I mean, I had 60 days. He had 30 days. It was a match made in heaven. Everyone in the rooms told me, hey, why don't you focus on the 12 steps? And like, if you came in not being in a relationship, you know, it was kind of like if the train is coming at me, I'm hurling myself at the train faster and harder. We moved in together. I didn't have a job or a car. I think he had a car, but no job. We borrowed the money from his parents. And I moved out of my parents' house in the middle of the night, like just left a little note, took all my stuff and my dog, really respectful and kind. It was okay for about 3 months. Like we were the cute couple that would go to meetings together and sit together and wear the matching shirts. And, you know, it was just like, really, I would look at him like with these doe eyes. And then relationships living together. I had never lived with a man and I was still drinking and drugging, right? Even though I was showing up to meetings, I was still using. And I would be standing there with a bottle of wine in my hands and he was like, are you drinking? And I'm like, no. Like, I'm a pathological liar. Amy asked me once, like, have you been drinking? I was like, no, somebody spilled a drink on me. Like, I can just come up with it off the cuff, right?
And I didn't believe that.
No, she didn't. She saw through it. She was sober. It was at the VBRC. I think that's what she tells me, at least. I don't really remember. But anyway, this fine young man went to my parents and asked for my hand in marriage. And my dad was like, F no, you know, like, you guys are a disaster. And that ring that you bought, she probably had to buy it herself, which was true. So great relationship. I quickly just burned that down to the ground and moved on to the next poor innocent man. And it got worse and worse and worse. Even when I stopped drinking, I would get into these relationships that were just in my head. Like, it might be someone at a meeting that I would see, and they'd have like this incredible spark. And I was like, ooh, I really like that. Shiny and new and a new victim, you know. It could be the guy at the gas station who was friendly to me. And, you know, I had my longest relationship was one that was long distance for over 20 years with a married man. It was all in my head that I thought he was going to leave his family and come and save me. You know, and absurd. Anyone that was healthy or kind or loving, I was repulsed by them. I had one friend who would come and drag me out of bars, pick me up at the hospital, get me from jail. He wanted to marry me and give me the world, and I treated him like garbage, complete garbage, because deep down, I felt that I did not deserve anything good or kind or loving or healthy. Even to this day, I still struggle with that. You know, so my sponsor and I made an agreement that I would stop dating for a year. It's been a long couple of months because I'm not getting that dopamine hit from the guys, right? I'm having to like really look at myself and say, like, I still got a lot of work to do. But the beautiful thing is I don't do it alone. Like, once I finally came in, worked the 12 steps, I realized that I wasn't alone. Like, whatever I walk through today, I have my sponsor, I have other women. I have a few guys that I trust because I'm not trying to sleep with them. But I have to really make sure that it's the right kind of motives that I have today. And the beauty of it is I get to wake up every day and start again. So I thank the program for that.
All right. Thank you. We're going to turn over to page 69. We reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subjected each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We asked God to mold our ideals and help us to live up to them. We remembered always that our sex powers were God-given and therefore good, neither to be used lightly or selfishly, nor to be despised and loathed.
I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. So my conduct had been selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate throughout my drinking days. I aroused, what is it? I don't know about jealousy. I don't think anybody's really jealous of me, but suspicion and bitterness. And I was bitter. You know, I didn't grow up an angry young kid. I enjoyed life. I had a lot of fun for a long time, but drinking just turned me, you know, and I became a bitter old soul. I remember thinking the same thing about relationships that I'd come to think about material things. It's no use having them because I'm just going to lose them, you know. That's the kind of thinking that I had, because I didn't really ever lose them. I gave them away, or, you know, didn't take care of them. So, you know, the last 10 or 15 years of my drinking would be very lonely, you know. It's funny how it's not funny, but, you know, we treat loneliness with isolation, right? And I did that. I had a lot of people that loved me, but that couldn't be around me, and I didn't want to be around them. Part of it was I didn't want them to see me like that, and part of it was that I was selfish and didn't want to share, you know, whatever it was. I'd never got married or had children, you know, and it never really was an option for me. Drinking was the most important thing in my life, and that's what I was going to do, because it stopped all those crazy fears and thoughts in my head. At least, you know, the time that it did that got shorter, you know, and I would wake up and be worse off, but I would still do it. A few short-term relationships, and then when the woman wanted to figure out how sick I was, which, you know, like I said earlier, was one of my biggest fears, that they would figure me out, you know, figure out who I was. That became easier and easier, I think. So when I got to recovery, I knew I'd have to do everything differently. I wanted to, yeah, my life to be embodied in the 12 steps and in a higher power. I didn't really, it took me a while to really believe that I could do that, you know, but watching other people do it, you know, inspired me to go through that process. And I wanted that to be my, you know, formula for relationships as well, as, you know, the principles in the 12 steps and my higher power. You know, I started to have, when I got here, I started to have intimate two-way relationships with other men in the program, where I told, especially my sponsor, that was really my first intimate relationship in my life. I told him things I'd never thought I'd tell anybody, you know, and that took a lot of that fear away too, you know, just like popping a balloon really once you do it. And, but like you, I was scared to death to do it, but I knew there was no other way. I had to do it. And so, you know, I went on to have a few AA relationships that went a lot better and ended a lot better. They did end, but, you know, it was more, you know, just mutual agreement and not a lot of fighting and name calling or whatever, resentment, you know, we just wanted different things. But I was grateful for the opportunity to learn and grow and watch other people have relationships. And because it took me a while before I did. And but I saw it was possible. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
So recently I did a fifth step in the library. We did my sex conduct in the library, which was hilarious. But it was in a conference room, so I felt okay. But I was still like looking around like, and as I was going through, as I was going through, my list of, victims, my sponsor was writing things down. Right. And then at the end of it, she handed me this list and I was like, what? And, it was my ideals, right? Things like would be based on honesty, like real honesty, not Elizabeth honesty, would be based on mutual respect, would be, you know, all of these beautiful concepts. And so I have it in my phone. And even today in like my interactions with men or women, I pull out the list and I'm looking like, where am I meeting the goals? Like, where am I right going the right direction? Because when it's full of me, it's going to be in my head. Like, it's not going to come from my heart. I'm going to be negotiating and manipulating and figuring out how to make you happy, how to make you love me, want to be my friend, want to have me in my relationship, because I don't trust that you really want to be a part of my life just for mutual friendship. So I have over the years been very selfish and dishonest and inconsiderate. Whom had we hurt? I've hurt lots of people in AA, right? Other women cause jealousy or dishonesty or gossiped. Like, gossiping is probably one of my biggest character defects, like, because I feel like at the root of it, I'm seeking connection with you. So in order to seek it, I'm going to give you a little dirt, right? And then you're going to be like, oh, look, she knows some things. And but then in the back of your mind, aren't you thinking, well, if she's talking about that person, isn't she talking about me? But gossip is a big one. So that's usually where I'm at fault. I don't like to come from a head level. I mean, I don't like to come from a heart level. I want to stay in my head. I don't want to have too many emotions. I don't want to be like too happy or too sad. and depression, right? Anger turned inward. I've been through many cycles of depression, even in recovery, because when I get down to it, I am just afraid of people. Like, I'm afraid you're going to see the real me and you're not going to like it. I'm afraid that you're going to find out all the shitty things that I've done over the time and you're going to like judge me. And so where are we at fault? I'm usually at fault. And writing it down on paper, there's something magical about putting it pen to paper for me, because I can actually see like the honesty, because in my head it's not very honest. So shaping an ideal for my future life, I definitely have to keep asking God how I can live up to that, because that piece of paper that my sponsor gave me is beautiful, but on an average day, that's not where I'm at. I'm still, you know, trying to be a people pleaser. I do want to say, you know, sponsoring other women, I try not to be the arbiter of anyone else's sex life. Like, you know, I don't want to judge what you do or don't do, because I've definitely done plenty for both of us. But it's improved over time. So.
All right. We're continuing on page 69. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice.
Dave, I'm not hot.
Hey, Dave.
So when I did my fifth step in the sex inventory with my sponsor, it was basically the same columns, you know, who, what happened, what did affect, what was my part in it? That's the big, big one. And then what's the defect or fear causing that? And what he had, what would I do differently? You know, kind of help shape the ideal. So my ideal is, as I said earlier, to have a relationship based on AA principles, and that involves God too. You know, I do my best to be courteous and honest, to think of others first, to be forgiving, to be present and supportive, to answer those questions. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? They don't come as often, I don't think, because I'm, you know, more open and honest, you know, and to keep God involved. It's different. It works pretty well, though. I'm not perfect, you know, but it's better. My sponsor gave me direction on the amends. I was not to contact most of the women, as it would open old wounds and be harmful. He had me make some donations to some charities that benefit women. I have seen a few of those women, however, in passing, especially in Charlottesville, where I'm from, and where I did a lot of my damage. And it just seemed the time was right, and I made direct amends to them. And I thank God made to wherever possible. You know, the girl that I was with for 7 years, her brother is a pretty good friend of mine. I've made living amends to her by helping him out. He's had a difficult go of it. And I, you know, I call him regularly. I see him when I can. He lives up in Richmond, and we have a good relationship. Yeah? And it, all these things, like you said, it's like service. It helps me more than probably anybody else, yeah, to do it. It gets me out of me. So that's it.
Thanks, Dave.
We earnestly pray for the right ideal for guidance in each questionable situation. It was about 3 years ago. I was having trouble with keeping one foot in and one foot out on this kind of ideal of praying for the right thing. There was a hot cop involved, and I knew that it was a really bad relationship. And so I said, like, God, please give me a very clear sign, like what I should do. And he did. And I didn't like it. I was like, no, that's not the sign I want. Like, like, okay, let's try this again. Like, God, please give me a very clear sign that this is not right for me. And the cop moved away. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess that's the clear sign. But I have to be like one of those things where I'm like, you know, the right answer will come if we want it, like the if we want it part. Like I can pray all day long, but if I'm not really meaning it in my heart, like it's not going to work. So most recently my sponsor and I, we went through this, and like Dave, most of the men on my list, I'm not to contact because, you know, I'd be just inviting trouble back into their lives. So finding other ways to make amends. One of my ways of making amends is I've never been married and I don't have children, but I do have a niece and two nephews. And I try really, really hard to be a good example of what a sober person is. Like my niece just texted me before this and she's like, can you bring me a pizza? And I'm like, no, I'm at a meeting. And she's like, oh, well, I'm glad you're there, you know, because she knows that this is kind of my medicine for me. She doesn't remember me when I was drinking and drugging, thankfully. But today I can talk to her about, you know, things like don't take a pill from anybody because you have no idea what it is. Don't do this. Don't do that. And she's like, oh, yeah, because you're sober. And I'm like, well, you know, it's a dangerous world we live in. But I do. I openly talk about it with them. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. In meditation, a lot of times the answer will be for me to lean into service work, to connect with another alcoholic, to walk away from whatever the situation is, and to just let it kind of heal. So over time, that is what comes to me in meditation.
All right. Our last reading of the night is on page 70. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself.
I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad you brought up the family thing. I have 8 nieces and nephews and 8 grandnieces and nephews. And I love them all to death, and I think they all love me, you know. And all of AA has improved our whole family. You know, I'm the alcoholic, but my relationships with my brothers and my sister who just passed and all those kids, it's just incredibly better, you know, and yeah, I just love spending time with them, and they seem to enjoy it too. It's really nice. I actually, you know, send birthday cards to everybody. I don't get many, but I send them out to everybody, you know, and I send presents to all the kids, you know, and yeah, I love them to death, and I'm glad I'm sober so I can be part of their lives. My relationships have gotten better as I've gotten better, you know. That's one of the promises, I think, and different words, but right, you know. I'm currently dating a non-alcoholic, which is a first, you know, probably since high school. And we parked next to each other at the condo. I bought this condo, and I started pulling in from work, and she'd be sitting in her car doing email or whatever. And we talk and, you know, have a laugh. And I don't know, a couple months later, she said, I don't know what your deal is, but you make me laugh. If you want to call me, here's my number. Yeah. And I said, well, my deal is I'm kind of seeing somebody, but I don't think it's going to last much longer. And it didn't. And but I lost her card. I'd shown all my buddies, though. And she called me. She looked my number up in the condo directory and called me on Thanksgiving Day. And this Thanksgiving, it'll be 6 years. And, you know, she was there during COVID. So she kind of listened to some meetings. She listened to me share my story, you know, got to know a lot about me that way. But she also learned a lot about the way the principles of AA and how they're applicable to everything. She has an alcoholic sister. We've talked about that a lot. So she doesn't want to be married, which is fine with me. She's been married before. She's got a kid. He's in college. He just graduated. And, but you know, it is so much better. And I'm better. And we're able to talk and converse at a level that I haven't done before. Yeah. And one little secret, we each have our own condo. That's kind of nice. But most of the time, I'm around, we're hanging out. So thanks.
Thanks, Dave. We earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance, for each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. So recently, like 2 months ago, I broke up with my best friend, who was a guy, because I was arousing suspicion in his relationship. We went no contact, and it was excruciating for me in the beginning. And I had to really rely on the steps, and especially the women in the rooms, to kind of keep praying for the right thing, right? Because full of self, I wanted what I wanted. Like, I wanted to be with my friend. And I was delusional about the relationship. So my higher power works through the words of other people, and tells me the truth about myself, even when I don't want to hear it. And sometimes I get angry and I push back and I'm like, no, you're wrong. You know, because the beautiful story in my head, it's like that beautiful mind. Like, I'm like the master chemist, right? If I can get the right guy, the right job, the right weight, the right antidepressant, the right this, and my dog, then life will be perfect. And it's not going to be perfect until I get all those components right. But the truth of the matter is, like, right here, right now, I am as my higher power wants me to be, you know, and I have not been in the rooms as much as I usually am because I'm taking care of my father, and he has dementia and he doesn't remember 8 years ago. Like tonight, he's like, why are you so dressed up and why do you have makeup on? Because at home, I'm like rolling around in pajamas and my hair is in a bun. And I was like, oh, I'm going to a meeting. And he's like, I don't know what that is. And so we were just talking about it. But to be present with him, to help him brush his teeth, to help him remember, like, tomorrow we're doing this and we're doing that. Like, it gets me out of me. It makes me to be present, because I don't know how much more time I have with that man. And I can tell you, he used to drag me into meetings and sit in his car and try to protect me from everything. Like, he one time wanted to build a jail in our garage to keep me safe from the world and probably keep the world safe from me, if I'm being completely honest. But just throwing myself in, I'm into the helping others. You know, I have sponsees, I have friends, I try to reach out to the newcomer. So that I'm not full of myself, because I generally am. So
thank you.
Thanks.
A couple of really interesting sentences in these readings. The first was on page 67. Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. And I've thought about that sentence a lot. And what I realized is that, fear, self-centered fear, my alcoholism stole all my dreams from me. It stole all the potential from me. It prevents me from reaching out and having relationships with you that are total relationships. Like, I'm great with having relationships with you, like, based on the certain characteristics that I think are going to be useful to me. But other than that, I'm not really paying that much attention to you because it's all about me. So I am robbing you of peace of mind. And I am stealing from the potential that my higher power has put in me. My God had plans for me, and I wasn't able to walk those things out. And because of my fear, I didn't make it safe for a lot of people to be close to me. I think it's really interesting that we have fear and sex together, because so much of it is tied up in the notion of being chosen. I want to be chosen. I want to be validated. I want to be wanted. And so I want a man to choose me, to prove to the world that I'm sexually viable, that I'm desirable, that I have value. It's proof. He's sitting right there. And I want to live a chosen kind of life. In the absence of having a normal functioning childhood, I imagined that everybody else's lives were perfect. And so perfect has been the bar that I've always been seeking. And unable to reach that bar, what I did was turn it on myself and assume that I'm so broken that I can't have what everybody else has. Everyone else has these magical lives where they have a straight trajectory from school to college to you know, career to house with a picket fence, wedding. And, you know, I can't even imagine having that kind of trajectory. I can't even imagine having those kind of goals. And what all of this is telling me is that I, not only do I not know what to do with myself, looking to you for that direction is going to harm both of us, because I'll catch a buzz off your attraction to me. I will use you to get high, or your opinion of me to get high, whether it's a sexual attraction or whether it's some other kind of attraction. For me, it's validation. And like Bill, I think life is supposed to be applause, 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 and maybe a few jazz hands thrown in for excitement and drama. But I think that's how it's supposed to feel all the time. And when it doesn't feel that way, I'm afraid it's because I'm to blame. I'm to blame. It's my fault. I've done something wrong. And so when I'm writing inventory, not just fear inventory, but resentments and sex inventory or harms inventory, conduct inventory, whatever I'm using it for, what I'm looking for are the self-centered fears that have driven the delusions that have led me into the trouble in my life. So those self-centered fears are things like mothers are supposed to have really close relationships with their daughters. And because I did not have a close relationship with my mother, that means that I'm one of the bad ones. Another fear is that anthropological theory of limited goods, that there's only a limited amount of good in the world. And if you get something, it means I'm not getting it. So you got mine, which means that we're all in competition. There's an invisible race, and there are winners and there are losers. Like all of these self-centered fears about what it feels like to be me on the inside and how there's something wrong with that. And then it spills out into everything else that I do. And how fear touches nearly every aspect of my life is I wake up in the morning and I'm afraid to go to work because they may ask something of me that I can't do. But I'm afraid not to go to work because who's going to pay my bills? And I'm afraid to not talk to certain people because then I'll look bad. But if I talk to them, then the pressure's on for me to keep talking to them and to maintain a relationship with them. And so this stuff just dominates me. And it's the dark side of self-centeredness. And what we find out before we even get to inventory, what I find out before I even get to inventory is that my troubles are of my own making. Of my own making. And that's the greatest statement of hope in the book, because it means nobody and nothing has to change in order for me to be okay. And it all comes back to this self-centered fear. I show the world my anger and my resentment because it makes me feel a little powerful, but really I'm afraid. I'm mad at you because you didn't smile at me. You're an asshole, but really I'm afraid that there's something about me you just don't like. And the mention of, am I going to rely on finite power, human power, lower power, or am I going to rely on infinite power, God's power? So this is another piece in the transformation that has to occur if I am going to become the kind of person who doesn't drink anymore. Because if I remain who I was, I will absolutely drink again. One of the best descriptions I've heard recently about alcoholism is that when people come in and just get physically sober, it's kind of like going underwater and holding your breath. And you know, sooner or later, you're going to have to pop up above the water. You're not going to be able to hold your breath forever. So it's kind of like counting days until I can drink again. Or maybe I won't want to drink again, but probably just counting days until I can drink again. And maybe I'll go to a lot of meetings and I'll do a lot of fellowshipping and I'll throw some tools in there. And it'll be like buying an oxygen tank. But again, the oxygen tank is going to run out of air and I'm going to have to pop up above the water. I'll be down there a little bit longer, but I'll have to pop up above the water sooner or later. And what happens in this process is that I become a person who can breathe underwater. I will be changed. I will be reborn. My life will be created, recreated. And all it takes really is telling the truth about these fears. The one thing I never wanted anyone to know about me, because I was sure if you knew, you'd reject me. But when I tell the truth about it, I create an environment where it's okay for you to tell the truth about you. And it turns out we're all exactly alike. All right. I don't know what time it is. All right, yeah. Let's be done. We're going to pass the basket in accordance with the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. A word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meetings can take place. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Hey, I
want to... Hey, Emily.
Chris?
Chris Raymer.
Chris Raymer.
Or you can look it up on our website, simpleactions.net. Any other AA related announcements? Dave.
I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Virginia Area Assembly is October 5th to 7th in Richmond at the Doubletree. You can go to aavirginia.org for info on that. And SASA, the Southern States Alcoholics Anonymous Service Assembly, is December 5th to 7th in Herndon. You can go to sasa.com, SSAASA.com, and get information on that. I hope to see you there.
Okay. Anybody else? Tomorrow night is the monthly Tidewater Intergroup Council meeting. You do not have to be an intergroup representative. You do not have to be a committee member. You don't have to be anybody at all except an alcoholic to show up. It is where you can find out about service opportunities, and service is what makes 12th step work possible. So the committees, the way that we interact with the neighborhoods and the communities around us. It is a great way to communicate, to connect with a larger body of AA members and to find out what's going on and what's available. 7:30 to probably 8:30 tomorrow night at the Easy Does It Club in Norfolk. Okay. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Literature is available on the table over there. Please see me or any home group member after the meeting if you would like to purchase a book. I think everything else over there is free. Sponsorship is in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available here after we close the meeting. Please feel free to come talk to me. If you're a little bit shy, you can send us an email at info@simpleactions.net. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside. Stay well away from the church doors. The buck can is right in front of the church door. We should move that. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website. If you hadn't heard it before, simpleactions.net. We're very proud of it. Meeting after the meeting. All are invited and encouraged to join us for fellowship at the meeting after the meeting that will be held just up Colonial Avenue at Cafe Stella. In closing, can we please thank the panel again for sharing? Thanks to all who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, everyone will have a chance to come up front and say thank you to Dave and Elizabeth. And Emily has volunteered to read the last few paragraphs on page 164.
Hey, Emily.
All right, we have a nice way of closing. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.